And, you know, because of the dissension between the, you know, religions in Belfast, you know, it didn't matter that night. It didn't matter. You know, nobody gave a damn. Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, whatever, they were all there, you know, and it was just a fantastic atmosphere for time. It'll stay with me forever.
How did set lists and things like that work with Rory then, going on stage?
No set list.
No set list at all?
Rory never used a set list.
Wow.
Never used a set list. No, anything went. Anything went. You know, I mean, sometimes Rory would just, out of the blue, he would play like a Beatles song, Rain. You know, it was a B-side of I can't remember, Day Trip or something. It's just start playing it, so you just joined in, you know, and it was fun. And it kept you on your toes.
Hello and welcome to episode 66 of Vintage Rock Pod, the ultimate classic rock podcast that proudly claims that my music is better than yours. I'm Paul Stevenson. Thanks as always for hitting play. Now, on today's show, I spoke with a man who is with Rory Gallagher for over 20 years, played on every single one of Rory's solo albums that amassed global sales of more than 30 million records. Phenomenal stuff. Now, Rory Gallagher, of course, is one of the true greats of the guitar world, and despite huge sales, he still remains somewhat of an unknown figure at times. The quality of his playing is indisputable, but he was labelled as the best guitarist you've never heard of, which is crazy when people like Eric Clapton, Johnny Marr, U2's The Edge, and Brian May have all publicly credited him as being an influence on them. And as I said, my guest today, Jerry McAvoy, was right by Rory's side all the way through his incredible solo career, which included 14 albums and numerous world tours. Sadly, Rory passed away in 1995, aged just 47. Now, Jerry is keeping Rory's music alive, touring the songs he worked with Rory on in his group Band of Friends. Jerry has toured with Band of Friends since 2014, thrilling audiences with Rory's songs across the world. Now, in this interview, Jerry talks about how he joined Rory, the dynamic in the recording studio and on stage. He talks about what Rory was like as a man, not just as a musician, and about the plans he has for the future too. He's going to be at the Great British Rhythm and Blues Festival in Lancashire this August, along with many other great acts, and it's a festival he's played many times in the past. So that is where we start on the interview. So you enjoy playing this festival then in particular, because it looks like a cracking lineup again this year.
Absolutely. And the atmosphere in the festival is fantastic. It's like a fun atmosphere. You know, you can walk down the street and go to different pubs, you know, and the restaurants, and there's always like frivolity. And there's no sort of there's no tension. It's just a really, really nice festival. Really good.
Excellent stuff. And obviously we were talking about Band of Friends, because that's something you put together a couple of years ago, isn't it? Well, probably nearly 10 years ago now. But just give us the information behind that then. Why did you decide to go with Band of Friends?
I actually moved to France around 2007, I think it was. And prior to that, My old sound system, my stereo, my record player was all in a lockup. So obviously when I moved over here, I managed to get it all out of storage and set it up, which was fantastic. And listened to vinyl again, which was fantastic. And of course, a lot of the vinyl I had was, Rory, the stuff I played with Rory, I played on all the albums. And I started listening to it again, you know, with fresh ears. You know, it's one of those things, you know, when you make a record sometimes, that's it. You put it away and let's get on with the next project. I mean, you know yourself, you know what it's like. And listening to the songs again, I just thought, bloody hell, the songs are great. I'd forgotten how good the songs actually were. And I thought to myself, it would be great to take this on the road, you know, with the right musicians. And I managed to get in touch with Ted McKenna, who played sadly we've lost Ted now, but he played with Rory for 3-4 years. And Ted was down lecturing at Glasgow, a college in Glasgow, Glasgow University. So he wasn't doing much playing, but he was well up for it, you know. And I'd met this other young guy from Amsterdam in Holland, Marcel Schiffen. So we got him on board and we rehearsed it for a couple of days. And we went out and did a couple of festivals in Italy and Spain, I think it was. And that was like through 2011, 2012, we sort of kicked off and did a couple of English shows, and it just rolled, it snowballed from there. I mean, the lineup has changed quite a few times now. Obviously, mm-hmm. We lost Ted a few years back. Brendan O'Neill's now drumming. Brendan said it was Rory for 10 years, from 1981 to 1991. got two guitar player, a guy called Jim Kirkpatrick, plays with a band called FM sometimes, and this bit of a wizard of the guitar, a young man called Paul Rose. So I'm enjoying the new lineup at the moment. So that's the lineup that will get called.
Fantastic stuff indeed. Well, let's go back to the beginning then, because when Taste broke up and your band broke up in the early 70s, now, when the call came to join Rory, what happened there? Tell me about how that came about.
So I was back in Belfast. I mean, we'd lived in London for a year with the band I was with, Deep Joy. We were over. We ended up in the same stable as Rory, as Taste, Robert Stigwood organization. And so we ended up doing a few shows together with Taste, opening for Taste. So I got acquainted a little bit with Rory, you know, over those months in 1970. And then towards the end of 1970, we were still sort of playing the clubs in London. And Rory and his brother Donald came down a couple of times. There was a club in Kensington called Blazes, quite famous in the 60s and the 70s. And Rory and his brother came down. I just thought they were coming down just to, have a pint and a chat. And that was it. And then, as I say, my band, Deep Joy, split up New Year's Eve, 1970. So 1971, I wasn't doing anything. I didn't know what I wanted to do, because the year in London was on a starvation diet, so I didn't particularly fancy come back to that again. And I think it was towards the end of January I got a call, and I thought it was Wilger, who was the drummer with Deep Joy, who stayed in London, and it was Rory. He said, "Jerry, how you doing?" I said, "Oh, Rory, good to hear from you, so and so." And a couple of niceties, chatting away, and then at the end of the conversation, he said, "Do you fancy coming over to London to have a bit of a jam, a bit of a blow?" So I'm thinking, yeah. Well, that was the initial get together. I mean, so I flew over to London, and we met up in a tiny little studio in Fulham Palace Road, actually. Wilger was already there, Rory was there, and Donald picked me up at the airport, Rory's brother, and we drove down there and we jammed for about three or four hours, you know. And it was just blues, rock and roll, none of Rory's songs. I mean, it was just it was great. It was great. And plus the fact, I mean, I was a fan when I was growing up as a kid in Belfast. I mean, I was a fan of Taste, Mark 1 and Mark 2. So to be standing there with this guy, and playing with him and realizing how good he was. That's the other thing as well.
I was going to say that, because obviously you said you're on the same bill. You did shows together. You've obviously seen him play live and everything like that. So when you get the phone call off him, I mean, what was your early thoughts of Rory as a person, then having watched him play guitar and then suddenly you're there alongside him?
I mean, as I said, I was a fan. I mean, I thought he was fabulous. I mean, coming from Belfast, because they moved up to Belfast from Cork, Taste, Mark 1, and so would see him in the clubs and that, you know. And to have the invitation to come over and play with the guy, I'm thinking, oh, man, this is amazing, you know. I mean, I, as a musician, I later years, I realized how good a songwriter he was, but as a musician, as a guitar player, he was fantastic. He was a one-off, absolutely.
Absolutely. And you talk about musician and songwriters. How did the process work then? Because obviously you did many studio albums with him. Did he come in with a song and say, this is what we're doing today? Or was it more collaborative? How did that sort of thing work out with you guys?
No, we'd rehearse, say for the first album, we rehearsed in the same little studio that we had the jam session in. And Rory would come in. He wouldn't he wouldn't bring a script in. He wouldn't bring any words in. He would just come in and start playing. Mm-hmm. So let's have a go with this guy. He wouldn't say if it's a boogie or if it's a shuffle or if it's a rock song or a blues. He would just play. And we would all join in, myself and Wilger, Wilger would get the tempo. And then I played guitar. I mean, I grew up playing guitar before I switched to bass. So I could see the chords. I could read the chords when Rory's playing. So I could just follow it. And we were given a carte blanche. I mean, within the song, the song was there. Rory had written the song, the structure of the song, but obviously your drum patterns or your bass lines, I just threw them in, added my own ideas, seemed to work.
Certainly did.
That was Rory's writing process. Yeah.
And when it came to putting down that first album and subsequent albums, it was almost no frills, wasn't it? There was not many overdubs on top of it. It was all kind of recorded live, a couple of mics in the studio sort of thing.
That's right, yeah. I mean, I think that's what Rory, he always tried to achieve, that sort of live thing in the studio. hence, we would play the song live. I mean, as far as solos and middle solos and end solos, Rory would do it as a band. And then if there was any overdubs, there'd be a little bit of rhythm guitar. But I mean, the solos were all done live. They were all, you know, they weren't created after the recording, you know. So it was all literally done live. And the second album, Juice, is even more pertinent about, you know, that really is live, you know.
So how does that feel then as a musician in the studio? Are you doing that song maybe, I don't know, 10 times, 20 times until you get the take that you're happy with?
I mean, I can remember sometimes we would do one take and that would be it. If the feeling was right, you know, I mean, other songs, you're talking about 5, 6, 7, maybe up to 10 takes, you know. I think as the years went on, we did more takes of songs. I think maybe Rory was looking for you know, something else. But in the early days, it was fairly straightforward. It was like a bang. It was like doing a gig, you know? I mean, and you were hot and sweaty after a recording session with Rory as well. You know, I mean, it was like a gig, you know? So, and then, you know, on the first album, there's a song called Laundromat, which we did 3 or 4 takes. I mean, that's a song that we never rehearsed, funny enough. I mean, Rory just brought it into the studio and started playing the riff. And I went, wow, this is a riff and a half. So we just joined in, but above so on. So we did 5 or 6 takes. And the one that Rory picked, which was, as far as he was concerned, that the best performance that we'd done out of the 5 or 6 takes, there was a bass mistake on it. And it's been on there ever since. And that sort of irked me at the time. But I can see where Ruby's coming from. You know, it didn't matter. You know, it's a little bass mistake, a little fluff, you know. But every time I listen to it, I hear it. No. But it was the performance that Ruby was after.
Indeed. And you talk about playing live and things like that. How did set lists and things like that work with Rory then, going on stage?
No set list.
No set list at all?
Rory never used a set list.
Wow.
Never used a set list. Nope. Yeah, I mean, Rory would just call the shots. I mean, normally on a tour, you'd find your way. Rory was obviously, you know, he was calling the shots.
Yep.
You'd normally have maybe the first two songs would remain those first two songs on that particular tour. But after that, anything went. Anything went. You know, I mean, sometimes Rory would just, out of the blue, he would play like a Beatles song, Rain. You know, it was a B-side of I can't remember, Day Trip or something. Or not. Anyway. And he just started playing it. So he just joined in, you know. And it was fun. And it kept you on your toes.
Honestly. I was going to say, yeah, did he ever throw in later on any of the kind of album tracks that he'd not played in a while? And it's almost like you've got to remember again and go for it.
Exactly. I mean, I remember, Cinder Boy, we used to be on the first couple of tours, you know, 71, 72. And later years, I mean, in the 80s, Brenton O'Neill was drumming at the time, and Rory just started playing Cinder Boy. Brenton never played it in his life. You know, I mean, I could just about remember it. You know, but we got there. We got to the end of the song.
Fantastic, fantastic. Yeah. And then speaking about the album Calling Card, I mean, that was the first time that a big name producer was kind of brought in alongside Rory, wasn't it, for the recording that album? And it was obviously Roger Glover, legendary figure, both as a producer and as a bass player and a musician in himself. But I've heard you say in the past that it didn't really work. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
I think there was a cluster between Rory and Roger as far as the direction they both wanted the album to go. I mean, I think Rory used the producer once in the past with Taste when they did On the Boards. Tony Colton Smith, I think, the singer from Heads, Hands and Feet, produced that Taste album. And I think it was just a clash because Roger obviously coming from where he comes from, Deep Purple, you know, like a very straight rock thing. And he was sort of, he was heading in that direction. Which is fine, you know. I mean, you know, and I think Rory was missing the roughness, you know, the rawness, you know, where I think Roger was heading for more like a Deep Purple type sound, you know. Obviously, we had the keyboards then, so it was like roughly the same sort of lineup as Deep Purple, you know, I mean, 4-piece, you know, except for no lead singer. And I think it's a shame, you know, because you're sort of caught in between the two of them, you know. It's a shame. It was just a terrible shame. And that's a good album, you know. I mean, it's a great album, you know. But I can see that there was a certain smoothness in that album that that you were pretty good with it in the other Rory albums.
And what did you find with working with Roger? Because, as we said, obviously he's a legendary bass player himself. And how did you find getting on with him?
I was fine, you know, because I mean, we'd toured with Deep Purple prior to that, 73, I think. We did like a 2 month tour, you know, in the States with Deep Purple. So we were all getting on great, you know. And I like Roger a lot. I mean, you know, and obviously being fellow bass players as well, you know. So there was something there between us as well, you know. And I didn't have a problem, but there you go. Such is life, celibate.
Such is life, indeed. And as we mentioned, you were really the only real constant, weren't you, with Rory all the way through 20 years. You're talking 2 decades. You recorded on all of his studio albums. You worked with him for so long. So what was it between the two of you that worked so well then, do you think?
There was a friendship, besides everything else, besides being musical partners. There was a friendship between Rory and I, a very close friendship. And I think also because of first of all, as I said, I was a guitar player before a bass player, so I could read things. And I know it sounds silly, but I think Rory, between us, we had this sort of telepathy thing. I can't explain it. I don't want to go down that road. I mean, you know, the telepathy thing, you know. But there was times I knew that Rory was going to play something before he played it. I mean, a lick or whatever, you know, it's just because I'd been there so many years, you know, and vice versa. Rory with me as well, you know, he could be sometimes, I was going to do something beforehand. I mean, it was just a great combination between the two of us, you know.
And we talk about Rory as a guitar player. I mean, he's phenomenal. Everyone knows that. He's one of the greatest guitar players we've seen. But as a person, what kind of a person was Rory?
He's very reserved, very shy. Rory, you know, he kept himself to himself, you know. But at the same time, I mean, when we weren't working, I mean, I'd meet Rory, I'd go up to you know, to Chelsea, whatever, you know, and we go out and have a couple of pints and go for a meal, and on the road, especially in the States, because Rory's a big movie fan, and as I am as well. So on off days, we'd end up going to see the movies, you know, go to the movies together, and you know, he enjoyed that. But he liked his own space as well, like we all do, you know. But as opposed to being extroverted on stage as he was actually quite an introvert off stage, you know. But we could have a couple of wild times as well, you know. So he wasn't that introvert.
I'm sure you did. And then, is there any moments that you kind of look back on now, almost that maybe stick in your head, and you kind of go, "Wow, was that me, or did that really happen?" Can you think of anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, a couple of things. I remember the first time we played Belfast, obviously my hometown. And it was during the Troubles, and it was sort of dangerous to go there at the time, you know. And what sticks in my mind was that the audience that night, because they were even starved of music. I mean, nobody went there in the 70s. Nobody. And Rory, every year, we would go back there, you know. But the first time he played it would have been 71 with Wilger. God rest him as well. it was fantastic. The atmosphere, and that'll stay with me forever, you know. And, you know, because of the dissension between, you know, religions in Belfast, you know, Catholic and Protestant, it didn't matter that night. It didn't matter. You know, nobody gave a damn. Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, whatever, they were all there, you know, and it was just a fantastic atmosphere for time. It'll stay with me forever.
And just back to now then, you mentioned that your current lineup, and you're going to be out on tour. We're going to see you at the Great British Blues Festival, but you're out on tour as well. You're going across the UK, and you've got some dates in Europe as well, haven't you?
That's right. We're actually doing the Rory Gallagher Festival, the international festival over in Ballyshannon, County Donegal in Ireland, and a couple of festivals through June, July, August, mostly festival stuff, including Cole, as we know. And then I think we do some UK shows in September, Irish shows in September, October, Germany, Australia, it's Austria, Switzerland, and then some French shows. And so, yeah, we're busy right up until the end of the year, and next year starting to build up. Obviously, after the pandemic, yeah. I mean, I'm not saying after the pandemic, it's still sort of hanging in there bit by bit, but I mean, obviously things are starting to open up a bit now, you know, which is great.
Absolutely. And then in terms of the music and the fact that you're bringing Rory's music back to crowds and stuff like that, what sort of reception do you get from people?
Mostly good. Let's hope it stays good. Yeah, it's great. And it's great to see. There's a lot of young people coming along as well to our shows as well, you know, which is great to see. You know, I mean, you know, when I say young, you know, in their 20s, the 30s, that's young, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's encouraging to see that, you know, these young people come along, you know, just to listen to what Rory's music was like. At the moment, we're actually in the middle of recording as well, a new album for a band of friends, which will be mostly, Arnold songs, but there were a couple of Rory songs in there. So that's due for a release next, I think, January, February.
Oh, fantastic. We look forward to that.
That's our progress so far.
Brilliant. That's absolutely fantastic. Brilliant. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you, Jerry. We wish you the best of luck for the new album and for the tour, and hopefully see you in Colne.
Absolutely. Okay, Paul, you take care. Bye-bye.
And a big thank you to Jerry McAvoy for joining me. Definitely worth checking out the Great British Rhythm and Blues Festival. Some great acts there. Tickets still on sale. It's a bank holiday weekend as well, so what more do you need? Just search for Great British Rhythm and Blues Festival online and you can get all the details there. Right now it's the time of the show for the top fives, and this week I'm going to give you my favourite five songs from Rory Gallagher's solo work. If you're not familiar with Rory's work, then please do take the time to check it out. He's astoundingly good. Perhaps have a listen to this top five and take it from there. But remember, this is my personal choice. It's highly subjective. I don't expect you to agree. In fact, I'd love to hear how you disagree, so please do reach out with your own top fives during this week too. So here you go, my top five favourite Rory Gallagher songs according to Vintage Rock Pod. At five is a brilliant rolling bluesy number, some say the perfect encapsulation of Rory. It features such a soulful bluesy guitar feel and fantastic solos too. From his fifth studio album Tattoo in 1973, at number five is A Million Miles Away. Four is a track from the 1976 album Calling Card. It's a proper hard rocking song, and the intro is such a brilliant riff. My number four is Moonchild. Just put your future in my hands. At three is a song from his seventh studio album, 1978's Photo Finish. At this stage, he'd trimmed the band down to a power trio, and this song is the peak of that sound on this record. It has brilliant solos, a pounding, relentless beat, and rocks hard. At three is Shadow Play. At number two is a song Rory wrote about a notorious British traitor. Lyrically brilliant, melodically catchy as hell. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. From 1979 album Top Priority, my number two is Philby. Time drags by, I'm above suspicion, there's a voice in the telephone. And at number one is another song from the Top Priority album. I love its big pounding beat. The guitar work is top notch as you'd expect. And again, its refrain is just so catchy and memorable. It's by far my favourite Rory Gallagher track. The number one song, according to Vintage Rock Pod, of Rory Gallagher's solo stuff is Bad Penny. So there you go, my top five songs from Rory Gallagher's solo work. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this list. Where do you agree or disagree? Please do let me know. Email me at vintagerockpod@gmail.com or catch me on any of the social media platforms. Just search for Vintage Rock Pod on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram or YouTube and you'll be able to find me there. I do hope you enjoyed today's episode, and if you did, please do hit subscribe on whatever podcast platform you're listening to this on so you don't miss any more future big interviews or the new daily This Day Rock shows. They are short 5-minute daily releases, and if you haven't checked them out yet, please do so. They are fantastic. That's it for me this time, though. I've just about got through it again with my voice. Remember, if you come across anyone who isn't a fan of rock, just tell them, my music is better than yours. Take care.